Blog Talk Radio.
Where?
Well, you don't have it now. It's not on.
Come on.
Israel Navy Commander Admiral Eliezer Maram issued a stark warning on Sunday for the organizers of the Gaza flotilla intended to set sail at the end of the month. And this is the quote. The Navy has prevented and will continue to prevent the arrival of the hate flotilla, whose only goals are to clash with IDF soldiers, create media provocation, and to delegitimize the State of Israel, Maron cautioned, speaking during the Israel Navy Divers Course concluding the ceremony. The Navy commander called on all parties involved to do everything they can to prevent the departure of what he called the provocation flotilla. Talk about a guy who's just lying through his teeth. He said that a number of figures in the international community have said that a humanitarian crisis in Gaza is non-existent and that all supplies may enter Gaza via the land crossings in a coordinated manner.
That's a lie.
Maram also added that the flotilla allows Hamas to get equipped with an unlimited amount of weapons in order to carry out terror acts on Israel. That's also another lie. On Friday, the Turkish organization IAH announced that the Mavi Marmara ship, on which 9 Turkish activists were killed last May when it was intercepted by Israeli commandos on its way to Gaza, will not take part in the up-and-coming convoy. Meanwhile, the Israeli Arab Higher Monitoring Committee, which was supposed
organizers of the flotilla expressed disappointment that Turkish IAH will not take an active role in the convoy, which will still set sail without the later this month.
Says that 9 people were killed.
Yeah,
meanwhile, the Israeli Arab Higher Monitoring Committee, which was supposed to discuss on Saturday the composition of its delegation for the flotilla, removed the item from its agenda in light of recent changes. The committee said that it had been invited by the Turks to participate in the flotilla. Due to the IHH's cancellation, the number of participants from the Higher Monitoring Committee is expected to be reduced.
It's also interesting to note that over 25% of those sailing are Jewish, okay, on that flotilla. And
of course, they won't tell you that.
Right,
the Jews won't tell you that.
But the people on the flotilla will.
They are not Zionists. Let's be very clear. There's a huge difference between Zionists and Jews.
In my next article tonight, this really disturbing, but very important, is the world debt is unpayable. The only solution is monetary collapse. this is by, Global Research.
Yeah, they always have good articles.
And by Bob Chapman. As far as we can discern, the U.S. Treasury thus far has spent and borrowed about $100 billion from the federal pension accounts. Again, I'll repeat, $100 billion from the federal pension accounts. Unless there is a vote on the cash debt extension prior to August 2nd, government will probably have borrowed some $250 billion to $300 billion. From that account. This is federal employees' pensions.
These are people that have been working for the government.
Yeah. The Treasury is paying virtually no interest on this debt, and three-month Treasury bills are currently yielding 0%. Our question is, how will the funds be generated to fulfill the Treasury's obligation to the pension fund? What happens if on August 2nd, legislation is not passed? Does this go on forever? Will we keep you apprised of new developments? And the current situation regarding the state of recovery in the U.S. has turned from precarious to dismal. And as we predicted a year ago, May, we will have to be treated to QE3, or quantitative easing 3, something no one really wants. But as we said before, it is inevitable. The Fed and their controllers, the member banks, owners of the Fed, know the present approach doesn't work, and it's only a matter of time as a result of their policies when more stimulus will be needed, which in turn leads to more inflation.
Due to the current state of affairs, Fed Chairman Bernanke has been making one appearance on TV after another. He gets grilled over and over again, and he doesn't like the public reception at all. He shouldn't, as more and more observers see, that two quantitative easings haven't worked. They cost at least $3.6 trillion in funds created out of the thin air, and all they have done is prolong the agony. The flip side is the policy has caused higher inflation. What else can one expect when deficits astound and the Fed has to buy $1.6 trillion in Treasury bonds? A large percentage of this debt is used to wage perpetual war for perpetual peace. During this process, the President has bypassed the Constitution and is deliberately repressing the freedoms of American citizens. There is no longer a separation of powers, but virtual dictatorship brought and paid for by Wall Street and banking.
It should be firmly implanted in your minds that your masters in government and those controlling government brazenly and arrogantly believe that they know better what is good for you than you do. That is why, when they speak to you, their answers are dripping with condensation, as if to say, how dare you question what we tell you? Fed Chairman Mr. Bernanke is a perfect example of this. He, others, and his predecessors have created a false economy based upon perpetual debt and upon money and credit being created out of thin air. Today, this is accompanied with zero interest rates, a combination that is, in time, can only bring a falling dollar, and inflation and a collapsing economy. Mr. Bernanke appears to believe that an increased supply of money has little or no effect on the comparison between money and the price of goods. He has to be living in a fairy tale land, thinking to such as this can only end up making a bad economy situation worse.
Bad economic situation worse. For more than a month, the U.S. has been faced with the task of extending the short-term debt limit. The game that is being played is that one side wants to cut the deficit and the other side does not. In reality, both sides do not want to cut anything, or should we say the elitists who control these supposed representatives of the people do not want anything cut. They want the game to continue so they can continue to loot the economy. An interesting take on this sideshow is if Treasury debt is not increased, the situation grinds to a standstill. Congress, the President, and the so-called negotiators want an increase in the short-term debt of $2.4 trillion. That would be a short-term debt limit of $16.7 trillion to carry the debt limit past the next election. The offset of reduced spending is to come over the next 10 years. How ridiculous and ludicrous! Do they really expect us to buy this charade?
The most recent strategy by the elitists is to keep Japan's problems under wraps. Do not let it into the media, even though some Japanese officials say the island could become uninhabitable. This is also why President Obama went to see Chancellor Merkel in Berlin. He urged her to make a deal to settle the Greek problem. He doesn't understand that such a deal would make her and her party, the CDU, unelectable for a long time, and the German citizens want Greece cut loose. They'll take their losses, and the results is many banks will go under. The president is as well trying to bolster his approval ratings. Well, I don't care if these banks go under. Who the hell cares?
Sure, but people don't care either.
The propaganda is flowing to keep Americans from panicking in the face of not recovering, no short-term debt extension, municipal and state failures, and Europe starting to collapse. The elitists are in trouble.
Serious trouble due
to these problems. The icing on the cake for them is the disaster that the Bilderberg meeting turned into in Switzerland. U.S. consumer confidence is lower now than it was at the beginning of the credit crisis. That isn't expected when unemployment is rising, retail is falling, and the manufacturing numbers out of Chicago and New York are falling steeply.
What professionals, for the most part, do not seem to understand is that the events of 2006 and 2007 have really never been solved. On February 2009, the inflationary depression began. There has now been a double dip since then. What we have witnessed is the slight revivals caused by the injection of money and credit. Unemployment is close to the same level it was two and a half to 3 years ago. The phenomenon has been the same in the UK and Europe. In the UK, the Bank of England and the Europe ECB are doing the same thing that the Fed is doing, and that is buying government debt by creating money and credit out of thin air. The City of London, Wall Street, and Frankfurt would have you believe these injections into the system were working, when in fact all they have done is temporarily bail out Wall Street, the City of London, and the European financial centers, as well as the governments involved. Nothing has been done to structurally assist the system and put people back to work. What readers have to understand is that what has been done to these economies does not work, and the participants know it doesn't work. Professionals who are not connected with the elitists have panicked because they do not understand what is going on, what is being done to them. The market was ripe to fall, but there is another important factor. Wall Street wants a short-term debt extension with little or no spending cutbacks. The new conservatives say, no, we're not going to do that. The market will be taken lower until these representatives see the light. How far are they willing to take the market down? Probably to between 8,500 to 10,000 on the Dow, or until Congress gives them what they want. In the meantime, they will attack commodities, gold, and silver, so no one can profit. Unfortunately for them, that isn't working this time. They are lower, but they come back every time they are artificially pushed down. We believe that is what this market correction is all about. Wall Street will take the market down as far as they have in order to get what they want. In the meantime, the Middle East and Europe are in turmoil and wars abound. A number of Middle Eastern countries, as they have understand that the market is fueled by major deficit spending and injections of money and credit as government inflates debt away. The economy and the market for the last 2 years have not justified stock prices at the level they have maintained during the period. The same is true for the UK and Europe. I apologize for my reading. Sometimes you just can't keep track of where you are on the screen.
Most of the professionals do not understand what is really going on and what is being done to them and their clients. Data is weak and getting weaker as economic statistics continue to fall and point to more problems ahead. This is ample justification for a falling market to aid the deliberate reduction in prices. We must remember that only bastion of gains for the public left is the market. If it comes down, Congress will hear from constituents loud and clear. That is what is supposed to force the issue on passing the short-term debt extension. All right? This article, let me say that.
Oh, boy.
This goes on, and it's very, very, very
important. It's an excellent article, but it's very, very long.
I'm going to cut it here, but I want you to refer you to globalresearch.ca. World debt is unpayable. The only solution is monetary collapse. All right? World debt is unpayable. So you can go to that. I also have this article posted on my Facebook under Leo Steele. All right?
The next 400 and
this is that thing you got to buy.
It's
just an ad.
Huh.
All right.
Who is Farrakhan is saying?
Yeah, I would put this on,
it's
kind of 10 minutes or so. That's a murderer in the White House. He's calling Barack Obama a murderer, Louis Farrakhan, and blast the coalition of demons attacking Libya.
I agree with him
on that. That's an hour and 24 minutes. You can check that out on YouTube. Farrakhan. I wanted to read this.
Well, we'll read that with the other.
Oh, you want to go back to
that?
Yeah, okay. That's
going to be at the end of the show.
No, well, not really. The end of the show is going to be involved with a whole lot of health issues, but okay.
I think this is very important. Groundbreaking U.S. Supreme Court decision.
Yes, it is, but I really don't understand this article completely, and it's much shorter than it should be.
Doesn't really explain it fully?
I didn't think it did. Because, for one thing, I don't trust this court doing anything, all right? And that's good for this country, the Supreme Court. Then the other thing it says, this article is put out by... Before It's News, yeah. And it says, groundbreaking U.S. court decision on the 10th and 9th Amendment. Ninth Amendment states that protection of rights not specifically enumerated in the Constitution. The enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. 10th Amendment, powers of the state and people. The power is not designated or delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Okay, but what all this is saying here,
the U.S. Supreme Court issued one of the best and most important decisions ever on federalism. The court unanimously held that not just states, but individuals have standing to challenge federal laws as violations of state sovereignty under the 10th Amendment. So in other words,
this decision is as radical in the direction of liberty as the New Deal was radical in the direction of socialism. And in short, freedom advocates like us just got a green light from USSC, United States Supreme Court, to bring more cases under the 10th Amendment. This will have huge positive implications for freedom so long as the current constitution of the court holds.
Here is our favorite passage. Federalism secures the freedom of the individual. It allows states to respond through the enactment of positive laws to the initiative of those who seek a voice in shaping the destiny of their own times without having to rise solely upon the political processes that control a remote central power. So individuals can bring challenges, I guess.
Yeah, we will put this precedent to work immediately when we file our opening brief in the Obamacare lawsuit Monday, and also in our defense of Save Our Secret Ballot against the
National Labor Relations Board
challenge, and many more cases to come. One other important note, sometimes little cases make big constitution law. This case involved a woman who was prosecuted under federal law for harassing her husband's girlfriend, not the set of facts ordinarily creating an important precedent. But some of our cases, too, are seemingly little, but with big principles at stake.
So we'll see how that plays out in the future.
But they did make this decision yesterday. So let's just see what happens there. I wanted to, instead of going through this, I wanted to go right back to my theory because I got so much on here. Another jerk-off senator, okay, guy named Mark Kirk of Illinois, is earning the hundreds of thousands of dollars the Israeli lobby dumps into his coffers. In a report based on a recent fact-finding trip to Middle East, Kirk calls for U.S. Naval and Special Operations Forces to support Israel in combating the upcoming flotilla.
In other words, he wants Israel to make war against American citizens.
Right. And he wants us to stop the group. He wants the U.S. to intervene and stop the flotilla to Gaza. Kirk's report reads that the IHH plan to send a second flotilla to breach Israel's coastal security later this month to prevent further violence in the United States should, number one, immediately designate the IHH as a terrorist entity. Imagine that. Okay, the flotilla people, a terrorist entity under Executive Order 13224, which targets terrorist organizations and those providing financial, technological, and military support, okay, to terror organizations. I mean, this is absurd. Making available all necessary special operations and naval support to the Israeli Navy to effectively disable flotilla vessels before they can pose a threat to Israel coastal security or put Israeli lives at risk. These guys are a peaceful mission, for crying out loud. They have no guns. They have no weapons. And make it clear to Turkish President Erdogan that Turkey will be held accountable for any actions that support or enable the IHH to launch its flotilla.
It's not leaving, Turkey.
And the IHH isn't even leaving.
Flotilla is set to sail to Gaza at the end of this month, aims to nonviolently challenge the Israeli blockade that has suffocated the Gaza Strip. Kirk calls for the U.S. Navy to provide special operations and naval support to the Israeli Navy. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, the guy's an asshole. And the guy's a
fucking
idiot.
Well,
you
know? He's being paid by,
by
Israel.
Because of a contingent American citizen will be part of a flotilla. Okay, so he wants the Navy to stop this because of the U.S. Flotilla. And Kirk would have no problem, it seems, with the Navy being deployed against U.S. citizens aiming to break the blockade, which has been termed collective punishment by the International Committee of the Red Cross.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So, I mean, this guy...
This guy should be thrown out of Congress.
I mean, why is he even there? What kind of a jerk-off is that?
Right? Well, he's owned by a foreign state.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And so, I mean, our whole country is owned by Israel, for crying out loud.
Or China, I guess, now, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's just... It is just horrendous what kind of traitors we have in this country. You know, it's just unbelievable. I'll read that later, too.
The Chinese government, this is interesting.
This one's fascinating, yeah. Let me go to that. Chinese government is buying up economic assets and huge tracts of land all over the United States.
In 2011, America for sale and the communist Chinese are eager buyers. The Chinese government is using sovereign wealth funds and Chinese state-owned enterprises to buy up economic assets and huge tracts of land all over the United States. Many of our politicians hail all of this foreign investment as something that is good for America, while many others see something much more sinister going on here. In any event, this is a trend that is rapidly accelerating and that is causing great concern among patriotic Americans. In my most recent article entitled, China Wants to Construct a 50-square-mile self-sustaining city south of Boise, Idaho, I examined a potential deal that Sinomac, a company owned by the Chinese government, wants to do with the government of Idaho. There will be more on this deal in a minute.
But first, it is important to note that this is a phenomenon that is happening across the United States. For example, a Chinese investment group is buying up a very large chunk of real estate in Toledo, Ohio. And even more disturbing is that as what has been happening down in Texas recently. The Chinese have been gobbling up our oil and gas fields. And the following is a quote from one local Texas news source about one of these deals. I have this article that I was going to read after this, but this already talks about it. State-owned Chinese energy giant, Canuck, C-N-O-O-C. Buying a multi-billion-dollar stake in 600,000 acres of South Texas oil and gas fields, potentially testing the political waters for further expansion into the U.S. energy reserves. With the announcement Monday, what it would pay up to $2.2 billion and a one-third stake in Chesapeake Energy assets, Conoco lays claim to a share of properties that eventually could produce up to a 500,000 barrels a day of oil equivalent. They're buying up our freaking oil reserves.
The China National Offshore Oil Company is buying up oil and gas assets all over the globe. They seem to have an insatiable appetite. There's not much we can do about what is going on in other countries, but when we allow foreigners to buy up our own precious oil and gas assets, shouldn't that set off national security and red flags? Now, not that our politicians are too concerned about real national security issues anyway. They just keep telling us that we will just be just fine as long as we allow TSA to grope our wives or our children and the elderly. Getting back to the topic, shouldn't we be alarmed that someday soon we may be importing foreign oil that is being pumped out of Texas land? It's almost as if virtually all our politicians have lost all common sense. Of course, one of the most insane projects was the one that Sinomac proposed to do in Idaho. The following is a description of that project from an article in the Idaho Statesman. A Chinese national company is interested in developing a 10,000 to 30,000 acre technology zone for industry, retail centers, and homes south of the Boise Airport. 30,000 acres is close to 50 square miles. That's a huge chunk of territory. Fortunately, it appears that the deal is stalled for the moment, but that could change at any time, especially considering the fact that the governor of Idaho is pushing hard for Chinese, and in quotes, investment.
Following quote from the Boise lobbyist, Pat Sullivan, one thing these Chinese see is we have a governor here who has a great big open-door policy. Doesn't that just sound wonderful? A great big open-door policy that's just so warm and fuzzy. All of this is part of Project 60, a huge initiative to revitalize the economy of Idaho. And You can go, this article goes on, and it's very, very good, and it talks about this whole thing, and it's the American Dream. I believe this is the, waking people up and getting them to realize the American Dream is quickly becoming the American Nightmare.
Yeah.
You look at that. And it's all the American Dream.
Scary.
It's frightening. This is another frightening thing that came up today, and I was really, really shocked to see it. 9/11, the Orwellian definition of conspiracy theory. While we were not watching, this is from Global Research, the CIA. While we were not watching, conspiracy theory has undergone Orwellian redefinition. A conspiracy theory no longer means an event explained by a conspiracy. Instead, it now means any explanation or even a fact that is out of step with the government's explanation and that of its media pimps.
That's the way it's been since
9/11,
For
example, online news broadcasts of Russian TV have been equated with conspiracy theories by the New York Times, simply because Russian TV reports news and opinions that the New York Times does not report and the U.S. government does not endorse. All right? And, in other words, the truth becomes uncomfortable for a government and its Ministry of Propaganda. Truth is redefined as conspiracy theory, by which is meant an absurd and laughable explanation that we should ignore.
You can go to that article.
It's by Paul Craig Roberts, a very good writer and columnist. It's on globalresearch.ca. And we now have our guest with us, Croy Sather, who is the author of the Dream Big, Act Big, Breakthrough and Unleash the Superstar Within You. He just recently ran across America, did a 3,000 miles in 100 days.
Yeah,
and,
amazing guy. Great book.
Yeah,
well, he's coming right on the air, and he's going to talk to us. Croy, can you hear us? You with us?
I can. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great having you. Really enjoyed your book. I felt very inspired.
Good evening, Troy.
Thank you. Good evening.
How are you? So you just finished your marathon run of, 3,000 miles. How are you feeling?
I feel amazing. I actually feel really, really great. It took me a couple days to recover, and I just finished up less than 2 weeks ago. I'm sorry, just over 2 weeks ago.
Right. That must have been fascinating, though. And I guess what you did is you gave a speech every day?
Every day I would start my day with a keynote seminar, mostly to either at-risk audiences or young adults, and inspire them to follow their dreams, create a life by their design. And then every afternoon I'd run a marathon or more every single day for 100 consecutive days without a day off at any point for 100 days.
Ah, that's good channeling for a hyperactive individual.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they called me hyperactive when I was a kid.
That's what it seems like, and that you can run off all your frustration or just have a great time and get into the zone.
But what's also amazing is your amazing recovery from.
Why don't you tell the folks that are listening a little bit about your story and some of the things that have happened to you and how you came to write this book?
Okay, well, we'll go all the way back to when I was 14 years old, and I'm 40 now. So back when I was 14 years old, I was riding home on my bicycle with my friends. I was on the right side of the road, and they were on the left side of the road. And as we're going over this little crest in the hill, a drunk driver came barreling over the other side. The drunk driver saw my friends, and she swerved, but she never saw me. And she plowed right into me, hitting my bike, crushing it below her big metal bumper, and launching me into the windshield. And then, according to the police report, I flew 50 feet into the air. So I spent they rushed me to the local hospital, which couldn't handle the trauma injury, so they sent me down towards New York City, where they worked on me for hours. And when my parents got there, the neurosurgeon, the head doctor, the guy who works on skulls and brains, he told my parents, quote, "If your son survives the night, he'll be a vegetable for the rest of his life." I was in the hospital for, I was in a coma for almost 4 days. I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. I was in cast and rehabilitation for a year. I had headaches from where I had fractured the back of my skull that literally would drop me to my knees whenever I'd have an episode. And then I had the challenges for decades beyond that. And then, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I guess you've recovered because you can run races.
I can. Physically, I recovered fairly quickly. It was only a matter of years to completely recover physically, but I ended up having psychological issues that I had to deal with for a while, and they weren't necessarily caused by the accident, but that was my excuse in life. So whenever things weren't going my way, I would blame the accident, and I couldn't remember people's names. I didn't do well on tests. I didn't do well in life, and I would blame the accident. And it wasn't until I let go of that, until a mentor taught me to let go of that, that I got to let go of that, that I stopped having those issues. So they were completely psychological as an effect of the accident.
But how much of it was, there must have been a part of that that was due to the accident. I mean, there must have been that physical or mental challenge that you had, other than just using it as an excuse. There has to be some bit of a disability there that you had to overcome. No,
for a while in the immediate years after, certainly. But then at some point, whatever that is, 1, 2, 3 years, whatever it was, that went away, and then all of it was completely psychological and emotional. And it was just a matter of me coming to terms with it. And that's the challenge that I'm finding with people that I coach now, is they're not coming to terms with events that have happened in their life, whether it's something as a child or an adult or a traumatic situation or just simply as many students that I've met that their parents just tell them every day, I wish I never had you, you're worthless, and you're never going to amount to anything. I've heard that story many times. And it's the same kind of result, and people don't know how to let that go. And it wasn't until I learned to let that go. I'm sorry?
They have that script running in their head all the time. And
absolutely.
Yeah, one thing you weren't aware of is that Lila is a child counselor in elementary school. She has been for about 25 years,
mm-hmm.
So
you're very familiar with all this then?
Oh, yeah. And I've been teaching SPED kids for many years as well, and in capacity. What? You look at me like you are the expert. we do this all the time. Don't feel good. We're familiar with it. But they have a lot of problems, and a lot of them are that attitude. That they've been told they're worthless for many.
Or that if you have a disability, it's hard to overcome it. But I really want to stress the positive things that you have to share. You have rules of success, and can you share those with the listeners, what your rules of success are?
Well, to build on what we were just talking about and to segue in, that script that we have, the same voice that we have, that record that we're playing in our head all the time, you get mm-hmm. to choose what kind of record that you want, what kind of recording that you want, that same script that you want playing in your head. So for the longest time, I let a script control my life for the negative, for the destructive side of me, and I ended up getting into a lot of trouble. But then at some point, I was taught by some mentors that I can change that I can choose that. So now today, my script, that record that's playing in my head, is that I can accomplish anything, I can do anything, and anything that I set my mind out to, I can do. And the Run Across America was one of the reasons for that, was not only to prove to myself, but to prove to the world that you can do anything. So what I talk about to my audience is three parts. The first part is to dream big. You got to have something that you want really bad, something that lights you up, that makes you feel fabulous, and you do no matter what, no matter what the pay was. And find that dream that you want. And then after you have that dream, you have to start taking action. So it's dream big and then act big and take massive action towards making that happen. And part of that was my run across the country to get me where I want to go. And a lot of people do that. This is easy. Dream big, act big. You have a lot of people that do those two things. But the last part is the part that differentiates those who truly succeed and those who are just wishers all their life. And that's
across
the finish line, staying with it all the time. I'm sorry?
Well, what caught me about your book originally was the I'm sure you must have read this, how was the Magic of Thinking Big. It was a great bestseller back in the 70s, I believe. You remember the book? The Magic of Thinking Big?
I'm familiar with it, yes.
Yeah, it was a great, great inspirational book. But basically the same concept and thinking big, you know, thinking in big terms, you know, as opposed to the small terms, and doing what you want, but doing what you want to do, and just it's pretty much like your book states, and based on that philosophy. One of the different things that you did mention, though, which I and Lila, I brought it up earlier when we were talking about it, was the people that influence you the most. All right. I think you said that there were five people that influence you the most, that you become, all right? And that, you stated that in your book.
Mm-hmm. Sure, the five people you hang out with most.
Right, but it's the five people that that you stated that actually influence you the most. Is that correct?
Believe it's the people who influence you the most, and sometimes that's one person or two people in certain circumstances, and other times it could be larger numbers. I think the five people you hang out with most turns out to be the people who are most like you, but the people that influence you are the ones that are going to make the most dramatic effect on your life.
Yeah.
Now, for you, who were the five people that made the most dramatic effect on your life?
When I was younger, it certainly was my parents, and they still have a dramatic effect on my life today, both good and bad, like every other person with their parents. But today, my contemporary people who are influenced me are people like Tony Robbins and Wayne Dyer and Marcel Silver, people that I've trained with, and then others that I study or have trained loosely with. Those are the people who influence me now. I look to people who have done way more than me, whether it's the athletic world or the personal development world. I go to people that have done more than I have. And at this level for me now, it's becoming a little bit harder to find people who have done more than me.
So, and I loved what you had to say, that if you want to be successful in a certain area, you should talk to those people that have success in that area. Like if your goal is to have a happy relationship, you want to talk to people whose relationships are happy, that are, you know, 30 years married in a happy relationship, not 30 years married and fighting and bickering for 30 years. I think you made it. It's a very simple, obvious point, but one that we sometimes miss.
And it's not something necessarily that if you don't have the money to go pay and go find somebody who can mentor you or tutor you and spend, you know, write big checks for. But it can be reading books, it can be observing, it can be asking questions. And most people have become successful in something in life. They'd love to sit down and have a cup of coffee with you and explain to you how they're doing it. It's human nature.
Right. We just love to talk about ourselves, don't we?
We do, of course.
We really, really do. So it's very flattering when someone says, tell me about your life. I want to be like you.
But, you know, there's something else that you stated, but something that I think is in books. Some writers have influenced me far greater than any individuals that I've known personally. Have actually changed my life. And I know others have been changed by things they've written. I mean, people who've lived 200-300 years ago, you know, stuff they wrote and we've read.
And they're still continuing to affect people today.
Because, I mean, certain people that were my heroes, you know, people that influenced my ways of thinking were Ralph Waldo Emerson. Was a remarkable philosopher, and changed my life and my thinking 35 years ago when I first read him, and continued to. And then others that great teachers. There's one. In fact, we saw Lila quotes him all the time. Sakya Trizin, who is a 41st patriarch of the Buddhist tradition. We attended a teaching of his, filmed it for them at their invitation, and played it for television. But that was one of the most remarkable 2 hours that we've spent with a man of tremendous wisdom and understanding, wisdom and compassion, which was the title of the teaching. But so it's people that you really run into, or people you don't even know, or people that you read sometimes that can change your entire... Well, look at Tony Robbins, like you mentioned. You know, He's transformed a lot of people's lives, yours included. How do you, I know the seminars are great, but books are great as well. And how is your book doing, by the way?
My book's doing fantastic, and it's getting fabulous reviews. I'm getting people commenting on Facebook and my website, and it's only been out for a few months now. It actually isn't even at the official release yet. It's still pre-publication, which is a copy that you have in your hands. And I'm getting amazing reviews, and what I like about it most is that people are saying that it sounds just like you talk. It's like, I can hear you. It's as if you're in the room. And that's what I love about it. That's the way it was designed.
It's a very easy read. It's easy to digest, and it's very understandable. But I would like to ask you, dream big, act big, but you know what? We all have a tendency to sabotage our dreams. And can you tell the folks at home who are listening how we sabotage our hopes and dreams and how to prevent ourselves from doing that?
What's going to happen with everybody in the life, and then this goes back to the script that we have, the blueprint that we have for life, and whatever that blueprint is, that's where you're going to want to stay. It's kind of like a set point for weight. If you weigh 200 pounds, your body's going to want to stay at 200 pounds, whether you diet or you eat more. It's going to want to stay there initially. So if you try going out of that and, say, become more successful financially and you start making a lot more money, if your blueprint is that you're poor and you should be poor all your life because that's how you grew up, then unless you change your emotional and psychological blueprint, you're going to go back to that. And that's what happened to me earlier in my life. Is my blueprint was that I was this runty little poor kid. So when I started becoming very successful financially in my early 20s, I ended up self-sabotaging it because I wasn't accustomed to that. That wasn't my blueprint, and I had to change the blueprint to stay successful.
How did you specifically do that, and how do you keep this new blueprint in focus? Because it's sort of like losing weight. Because unless you keep your new dream in focus, that old way just kind of slips right back in. You're right. So how do you maintain that focus of your dream?
The weight metaphor is absolutely accurate. It's the same exact thing. I believe that as humans that we're designed to survive. And that's it.
Right.
We're designed to be here and to live and to not do anything more than we have to do because that's millions and millions of years of evolution.
Right.
But to do more than that, it's just like if you want to lose weight, you have to stick with it constantly. You always have to go to the gym. It's a lifestyle. You have to go to the gym all the time, and you have to eat well all the time, or at least the majority of the time, I should say. And for success, it's the same thing. You have to be there the majority of the time, be where it's successful, and it's going to be hard. You're going to fall off, and you're going to get knocked down, but you have to get back up and get back to the gym and start eating the right foods again. And for your mind, for success, that's getting the right kind of food. So what we were talking about before, books, seminars, meeting people, asking them about success and constantly moving in that direction. Unless, of course, you want to end up at the end of your life and you want to be broke and unhealthy and miserable, and I mean, that's always an option.
I think I'll pass on that one.
That was a great book, probably the first motivational book that was written in the 20th century. It was called The Laws of Success by Napoleon Hill.
Sure.
Napoleon Hill.
Yeah. And
yeah.
And Think and Grow Rich. I, back in the 70s, actually late 70s, I was when I first read The Laws of Success. I picked it up as a group of books from a used book sale. And then I read that, and it changed my, it totally fascinated me. And it changed my way of thinking. And then I picked up Think and Grow Rich, which was the next book that he wrote, and which became the greatest bestseller during the Depression, during the Great Depression in the 30s and 40s, of course, and all through the 20th century. But the remarkable thing about that is I found myself having to continually read it. I had to read it at least once a year. All right. For about 5 years before before it was able to sink in, because I would get on a roll with that book, and then I would finish the book, go through the motions, do whatever, achieve whatever it was I wanted to achieve at the time, and then for some reason slip back into complacency, and then I'd say, well, geez, what the hell is going on? And then I'd pick up the book again, and I would reread it, and then I'd get back on track again, like getting back on a ladder and climbing it. But I found myself falling back, you know, and I still do that today. Even though I should reread the book, but I don't have it anymore for some reason. I lost it over 30 years. But in essence, isn't that, do you find that your students or your...
Or yourself.
Or yourself or whatever do the same thing? Or do you, have you been able to permanently fix that thing in your mind, you know, that stay on track without, you know, revisiting all the things that have first inspired you?
Some of them have become a permanent part of my DNA now, if you will, part of my blueprint. But really? Other things are not. And it's just like you were saying, I go back, I read Think and Grow Rich. It's a fabulous book. It's a staple. And in fact, everybody should read that several times over. And every time you read it, you're going to get new things out of it. I read some of the contemporary masters all the time. When I'm in my car, I have audio books or audio programs, constantly listening to them. I go to seminars all the time to great motivational speakers or learning a skill. It never ends. Not if you want an extraordinary life, it never, never ends.
Did you ever read Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich with Peace of Mind?
No, that one I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, most people aren't, because it was the last book that he wrote, and he wrote it when he was 80 years old, and he died about a year after it was published. But that book was probably the most amazing book, because what he did in that book was he described what was his motivating force behind the all of his work throughout all those years. Now, are you ready for this?
Sure, go ahead.
He had channeled a spiritual guide. Yes, he had a spiritual guide, and the book is available. You can buy it on Amazon. You can get it in Barnes & Noble or whatever. It's still published. But it's called Think and Grow Rich with Peace of Mind.
Hmm.
And he explains how all of this was done, but all of his guidance throughout his career, which he had a phenomenal career, was all guided by this spiritual guide.
Now, do you think that you've tapped into like a bigger voice, a universal voice? And I can tell from the way you're writing that you believe in the law of attraction, that if you put out there a positive, good attitude, positiveness and good things will come to you. Is that not correct?
That's certainly correct. And the law of attraction, and certainly in the way we know it through the more popular books that are out now, is true to a big extent. I think they've missed part of part of the story with that, and that's the part about you actually have to do something. You can't sit there and say, I wish I had a garden, but not actually get out there and plant the garden.
I find that interesting, too, that people talk about thinking positively, and they do that sitting down, and they never go to action to make that positivity happen. There are a lot of people that don't realize that, you know, you have to go the next step.
Yeah, everything in life is about taking action, and while all these other things are part of it, certainly components, you definitely have to take action. But to answer your question, if I feel like I have a spiritual guide or I'm not totally certain on how to define that at this moment, but the one thing I am certain of is that while I was running across the country, there was a greater source than me that was guiding me as I was going across the country, and it was quite phenomenal. People that would end up in my path and things that would happen and where we ended up and the people that I ended up talking to, and I ended up being in people's lives that needed me just at that exact moment. And the same thing, the opposite, where people ended up in my life at the exact moment that I needed it the most. And it just is absolutely extraordinary. What you call it, I'm not too certain yet. I'm still trying to figure that part out. But there is definitely a bigger source that helps everyone.
Isn't it marvelous that you get to meet so many people and talk to so many people? I mean, except for the kind of life that you're leading, you probably wouldn't have ever come across these people. I think that's marvelous.
It was one of the greatest parts of the whole run across the country. It, definitely the people and who I've met, and there's some extraordinary, amazing people in every single corner of the country, every corner.
Now, of the people that that inspired you, Tony Robbins and so on, have you met these people personally? Have you met them or gone to their seminars, met them, know them personally? Or
a few of them I know personally, and I've trained with them intimately, and then other ones that I know from either going to large seminars or other training events like that. Like Tony Robbins, I've met him personally, but I can't say I know him, that's for sure. But others I have trained with personally.
How about that guy with the, I forget his name, very famous guy. He wrote the Erroneous Zone. That was his first big hit, the Erroneous Zone. The guy
is that Dr. Gray?
No, he does a lot of, he used to do a lot of stuff on, you mentioned his name. But,
oh, Dyer.
Dyer, yeah.
He's on CPTV.
Yeah, he used to do CPT, public broadcasting, quite a bit.
He's still on that pretty regularly.
Is he? Dyer, have you met him, or have you just read his books? Or?
No, Dyer is somebody that I've only read. But the people I have met and trained with intimately is Marshall Silver. He's a huge factor in my life. He teaches subconscious reprogramming. He's out in the Nevada area in Las Vegas. And then a lot of athletes I've trained with personally, Stu Middleman, and now I'm just starting a relationship with Marshall Ulrich, incredible ultra athletes. And from there, and then I've trained with some other people with lesser degrees.
Have you ever seen or read anything or heard anything by Zig Ziglar?
Oh, sure, yeah. I've read many, many of his books.
Yeah, great fun to listen to him. I guess what I wanted to ask you of all things was what continues to motivate you and keep you going. I mean, is there a spiritual essence to that, or is it just your? Is it a habit now that you've created? I mean, what would you advise people? What is the to keep you going? I mean, you're doing some seriously tough physical exercise, physical feats, triathlons and, running across America and stuff like that. And these are things like, for instance, I personally can't do them because of different reasons, but and also my age. But, if you were, is what keeps you motivated? Like, for instance, Lila is an athletic person. She works out 2 hours every day religiously for her whole life, swimming and whatnot. But that's a habit that keeps her motivated and keeps her going. Is that yours as well, or is that more of a, or do you have more of a something else that keeps you motivated, keeps you going?
What drives me, what motivates me at this point in my life, as I mentioned earlier, I'm 40 years old now. Is the idea that my life is going to come to an end at some point. Typically, we're about 80 years old is our life expectancy now, roughly. So I'm halfway through, and I know that we're all put on this earth for a purpose, a major purpose, a significant reason, and I know what mine is, and I'm out to make sure everything happens that I do to achieve all the things that I was put on this planet to do. And I don't want to be at the end of my life looking back on my final days and reminiscing and saying that, wow, I could have done this, I could have done that. What if I did run across the country? I wonder if I would have done that. What if I did become that motivational speaker I always dreamed about? I don't want any what-ifs. I want to know that I did everything I possibly could and achieved everything I could and lived up to the standard that I was put on this planet for. I'm certain we all have that reason. Some of us just don't do that.
So you've combined your athleticism, your sense of adventure, with giving with motivational speeches and working with people. That's a great combination. Is that how you, is that your dream or vision?
It's combining the three things that I'm very, very good at. One is my physical aptitude, and that's not from sports. It's actually from construction. I've spent most of my adult life in construction. So I have an incredible work ethic, and I can tolerate a ton of pain. That's what makes me such a great long-distance runner. It's not about the running. It's about tolerating pain. That and the teaching, the seminars, being on stage lights me up. I love doing that. So you combine those two. And then the last component is the philanthropy. As I ran across the country, I gave away almost 10,000 books to my audience members, which were mostly at-risk audiences. And you combine the three, and that's where I'm going with life. It creates an amazing trilogy.
That's really wonderful, and I can hear the joy and excitement in your voice. So you've really found your niche in life, and you really seem to love it. And what I like about your book is that you're sharing with all the rest of us how to achieve that same vision and happiness and excitement in life. I mean, everybody's blueprint is a little different, but we all, as you say, have the ability to achieve it. And I love the positive message and voice in your book.
Now, this is your first book, is that correct?
This is my second book.
Oh, your second book, okay. My
first book was Better Body, Better Life, and that's about health and fitness.
Oh, right. How did you, what? Oh, it's already, is it 9 o'clock? All right. Maybe we can have you back again. We're running out of time, and we got another guest going on. But we wanted to we'd like to tell people about your website and about your book again. Your website is. Could you tell the people what that is?
Sure. The website and the name of my book are all the same. Make it nice and easy. It's dreambigactbig.com. Same name as my book, Dream Big, Act Big. And on the website, you'll be able to find the book. You can purchase it there, pre-publication edition, and also the amazing videos from when I ran across the country, as well as some new and upcoming things, including my next big challenge, which is going to be in mid-August. It's going to be even bigger than running across America.
Can you tell us what it is?
It's breaking one of the world records in ultra running, one of the most intense, dangerous, ridiculous things that you've ever heard of. I'm going after the biggest thing out there.
Well, you know, we would love to have you on after you accomplish that. We really love your book, and we urge all of our listeners to purchase it. It's really upbeat, and you give people a lot of direction in what sometimes can be a very directionless world.
And it's certainly the case. We all certainly need a roadmap and some guidance, and everyone. There's no exceptions, and this book is a great foundation for that. And thank you for having me.
And we want to thank you so much, Croy, for writing such a great book and being on our show, and we look forward to having you on again.
Yes.
Thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
I wish you a lot of success. Good night.
Pinot was given 100 P-40 Tomahawk fighter clearance, just rolling off the Curtis Wright assembly lines. Living and working, enduring short.
To have Woody in the ring on in just a moment.
Yeah, hang on a second.
We're going to go to his music.
Yeah.
Right now.
There we go.
Went off.
Did that work?
No.
Yeah,
just a second. We'll go to his
music. Hold on a second here. Let's bring Peter on.
This evening?
Oh, it's much better now. In the beginning, it was a little fuzzy there.
All right, but right now we're good, right?
You sound all right now.
You sound all right.
That's great, thank you. Well, geez, I was wondering why you guys don't kiss my ass like you kissed the prior guest's ass. I'm just wondering. Anyway, good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes.
I don't know.
As you step into the ring with me, tonight's topics: put up or shut up, luck of the Irish. Tigers are sliding. Pujols out. And other baseball news. Now, let's get right down to it. As most of you may recall, the NFL season is in the balance right now. Which way is it going to go? Is it going to be on or is it not going to be on? And the heat is on Commissioner Roger Goodell. He's got to make or break it. An imminent resolution to the NFL labor strife could hinge on an emergency meeting that was held in Chicago today. The owners are gathering for the first time since a flood of apparent progress in secret labor negotiations during the past 3 weeks. Kind of offered like a legitimate hope that the lockout could be ended in time to salvage the entire 2011 season. Now, that optimism was tempered late last week by several small market owners worried about a long-term agreement impact on their bottom line. And there is now a concern that enough complaints at the meeting this week could scuttle projections of a deal by next month. As a result, the onus here will most likely be on NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell to get the owners, now split mostly along the lines of big market versus small market, on the same page this week. If Goodell can get them united at the meeting, then you'll probably see a deal in a relatively short order, according to a league source. If there's unity out of this, mid-July wouldn't be unrealistic for an agreement. New York Football Giants co-owner John Mara, one of the key participants in the meeting of the labor committee here yesterday, indicated after meeting that he remains optimistic but refused specific comment. Kind of basically what the deal is, the small market teams want revenue sharing and the big market teams want to keep the money for themselves. What a surprise. The judges in the players' ongoing antitrust lawsuit against the owners have essentially ordered the sides to negotiate in a private and not through the media. And Mara said the owners plan to abide by that. As much as I would like to comment, we're going to follow orders, Mara told a local newspaper. Now, although the owners have been advised that the meeting could stretch into tomorrow because of the complexity of the potential agreement, league sources said it's unlikely they will take a formal vote on it anyway. The meetings instead are expected to be more of a venting session where the small market guys such as Mike Brown of the Cincinnati Bengals, Bills owner Ralph Wilson, and Wayne Weaver of the Jaguars get a chance to voice their concerns about trying to keep up with the big market teams under the new deal without increased revenue sharing between the owners themselves. That divide among ownership remains strong as big market teams such as the New York Football Giants, the J-E-T-S, Jets, America's team, the Dallas Cowboys, have opened luxurious new stadiums in recent years without having to give much, if any, of that extra income to their fellow owners in less lucrative markets. Now, there doesn't appear to be enough opposition from the small market teams at this stage to prevent any kind of deal. Form approval from just 24 of the 32 teams is needed. But these meetings could be a wild card if the debate inside the room gets heated enough and Goodell proves ineffective. But if the owners show relative unity, sources indicate, you know, as I said, the deal could come together quickly, especially since negotiating teams on both sides are expected to resume their secretive talks later this week at an unspecified location. You know, basically, the NFL knows that they got to get this deal done, and they got to get it done quickly. The question is, you know, are the big market guys going to stick together enough and, you know, are they going to be able to get the vote through? And will there be bad blood afterwards? You know, a lot of these small market teams, you know, they want a bigger piece of the pie. But if you look at some of the revenue sharing in baseball, a lot of times these small market teams, they just take that money, don't bother putting it back into the team, and they put it right into their pockets. Look at teams like the Pittsburgh Pirates, the Kansas City Royals. You know, they get all this money from teams like the New York Yankees, the Boston Red Sox, the New York Mets, you know, all of which have, you know, their payrolls are bigger than they're supposed to be, so they pay into that revenue sharing deal. And you know these teams are getting the money, but they're not putting it into the team. They're not signing agents and stuff. Part of the problem is they're taking money, but they're not being forced to spend the money on the team that they're taking it. And to me, if you're going to have revenue sharing and you're going to take money from these big teams and you're crying how you can't compete, well, don't just sit there and take their money, and not try and improve your team and be competitive, because that's not really fair, And that's not the whole point of the revenue sharing in the first place. The whole point is you're supposed to put the money back into your team. Anyway, moving forward, golf has been in what one would call a little bit of sleeper mode these days. Tiger Woods has, slipped far down in the rankings, in the world rankings. And the question, lately has been, who's going to be the next guy? Who's going to be the next guy? Because you have guys like Phil Mickelson, slowly coming off of the main stage. He's getting older now. Injuries are catching up to him. And he can have a little run with his game, but, what's it going to be? And right now there just isn't any really, great golfers. I don't know who the next American's going to be. But certainly it appears to me that the next great golfer, period, although he is a foreigner, will be this young man, Rory McIlroy. Now, he won the U.S. Open this past weekend. He did it rather handedly. He did it in Tiger-like fashion, where he just totally smoked the golf course. You can compare it to Tiger's run at Pebble Beach. However, this course that McIlroy won on, a lot more people were under par, whereas when Tiger won in Pebble Beach, the course itself was more difficult. Guys weren't hitting under par. It was just a totally different ordeal. This course was very simple this weekend. Now, apparently, that was due to some expected rain, and the rough was supposed to grow with the rain, and it would make landing in the rough that much more difficult. The rain never came, and the pin placements were relatively easy, and if you hit behind it, you had a little bit of a roll, so it would bring your ball right to the jar. So the course wasn't exceptionally hard, but hey, everybody still played the same course, and everyone had the same chance to go as far under par as McIlroy did, but no one certainly did it. Those that are in the know in the golf world have said that this guy's been waiting in the wings, that it's gonna happen, and it finally happened. Now, he seemed like a good kid, answered the questions rather nicely. Me personally, never been a big Tiger fan. He always seemed so robotic, seemed like a prick. He just seemed very unpleasant. This guy seems to be the opposite. I couldn't help but notice that when they asked him, what winning meant to him, he said, I love the cup and all the names that are on it, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And he went down a whole list of names of great golfers. And, gee, what was the one person that he didn't mention? Tiger Woods. Kind of interesting. The kid said last year that Tiger Woods doesn't scare him. That brought a little bit of a controversy. That certainly got people interested in talking. But the kid has a great game. And, obviously he's quite far away from the number of majors. He's won one, and Tiger's won 14. But, this kid could dominate golf for quite some time. It'll certainly be very interesting to see. And I think it'll be great for the sport that if Tiger comes back, and Tiger can still come back at age 31, and, it's not ready for his career to hang up yet, or is it? We don't know. Tiger certainly has had a number of injuries, and now the mental aspect of his game has been questioned as well. So we'll have to see, but it would certainly be very interesting to see this young kind of gun go up against Tiger, to stop Tiger from winning, obtaining Jack's record. And the only way Tiger is going to be declared a better golfer than Jack Nicklaus is if he wins more majors than Jack did. When he was on this run a number of years ago, people that, to me, knew very little about golf were like, oh, it's in the bag, blah, 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 blah. And I just kind of sat there and said, not so in the bag. I mean, I've played golf myself, certainly not at a high level, but a lot of stuff has to go your way to win a lot of these championships. And, you know, over time, stuff stops going your way. The ball doesn't bounce your way. Mental stuff, you get married, and, you know, you think about things differently. You know, just, you know, that was one thing people said that, you know, once Tiger got married, watch his game and see what happens, because a lot of times it affects his game. You know, affects players' games. And certainly if you look at the numbers from Tiger from when he got married, you know, what went on during the marriage, and then, you know, obviously with the implosion of the marriage, it certainly proves to be true. Marriage, not good for game. So that's kind of interesting. But as I said, it would certainly be good for golf if Tiger can kind of revive his game a little bit and this guy can maintain his game a little bit and then he could go at it for the next couple of years. Certainly would be very interesting, and it would certainly be very good for the game of golf. Okay. Not for the good for the game of baseball, certainly not for the St. Louis Cardinals baseball team. They're at the top of the division, and they've had a number of injuries this year. But perhaps the most significant blow came Monday when their three-time MVP, Albert Pujols, was diagnosed with a broken left wrist that could sideline him for 6 weeks. I would definitely say longer than 6 weeks, and it is certainly going to affect the way he swings his bat, not just for this season, but possibly for the rest of his life. 6 weeks is a long time, according to manager Tony La Russa. But he believes they're deep enough to cover and remain competitive, that this kind of thing heals and doesn't linger. So he says, Pujols' ability to return and be a force for the Cardinals, who are tied for first place in the National League Central through Sunday, remains to be seen, as does the injury's possible impact on Pujols' free agent value. Definitely going to lower his value. Frankly, I kind of thought Pujols was stuck in St. Louis, you know, when the Yankees signed Teixeira and the Red Sox got Gonzalez. I mean, big payday for Pujols is definitely not on the East Coast. I noticed he's been kind of chumming up to the Chicago Cubs. Maybe, you know, he might be able to get money there. Frankly, with this injury, I don't think he's going to leave St. Louis. He was also offered a 9-year deal worth about $195 million this spring, but rejected it. Gee, I wonder if he wishes he didn't do that now. And the two sides agreed to delay negotiations until after the season. This will be Pujols' longest ever stint on the DL, which means he almost likely finished with his worst statistical season in 11 years. He's a career 329 hitter. He's batting .279 with 17 home runs and 45 RBIs. He's 31 years of age. He got this on Sunday when he collided with Kansas City Royals base runner and former Yankee Wilson Bettman. It was just kind of a weird play. The guy threw the ball in there. Pujols kind of reached over for it. And, you know, the guy just ran through it like you're supposed to. I mean, it certainly wasn't the runner's fault. And, you know, frankly, I think that Pujols should have been kind of paid a little bit more attention to where he was catching that ball. It just, you know, you got to pay attention to that kind of stuff for, you know, a guy like him who's been in the league a number of years. I'm kind of surprised that went out like that, but it was one of those kind of those bang-bang things, and, you know, what happens, happens. So, anyway, moving forward a little bit. Speaking of injuries, the New York Yankees have just, you know, been kind of decimated by injuries this year. I kind of was interested to see this Eduardo Nunez kid come in and fill in for Jeter. You know, he's kind of done it with the bat, but his fielding has been absolutely atrocious. Every time you go to make a double play, you're like, oh, my God, is it going to work? A lot of his throws in general are just kind of garbage. He's missed a couple easy balls. But, you know, he's been all right with the bat. You know, he's livelier. He's got livelier legs, you know. But, wow, I never thought I'd say this, but I'm really missing Derek Jeter's defense right now. Yeah, and since the rest of the team is really starting to hit now, Derek not hitting really wouldn't be that big a deal. To me, I think one of the greatest improvements that the Yankees have made is the fact that Nick Swisher is hitting now. With Swisher hitting, that means he provides protection for Robbie Cano, and Cano's numbers have gone up. Swisher also, by the way, is playing for basically a Yankee contract. If, you know, he finishes out and has a good season, then the Yankees will probably pick up the option for $10.5 million. If he doesn't, they're probably just going to let him go. Frankly, I think Swisher is liked by the organization. He's kind of a rah-rah guy. He's good in the clubhouse. I think he has a lot of allies there. So I think that, you know, Swisher does manage to, you know, keep his numbers up and everything else. I think the Yankees will probably sign him. You know, I just I don't see the Yankees letting him slide elsewhere. And the Yankees have too many other holes they're going to have to fill in the offseason when they can just pick up the option on this and make it over and done with real easy. They have too many other targets that they're really going to have to work on, whether it's via trade or just, you know, signings, whatever the case may be. I mean, they're going to need a couple easy ones, and this is an easy one, kind of a no-brainer. Just keep Swish. He's only 31 years of age. And you know, we'll figure, you know, if you want to, you know, get rid of him after that year, then fine, then do that. But, you know, the Yankees have way too many other holes that they're going to have to work to fill. So I don't think they need to work on filling an outfielder hole when they have got a guy that can do just fine. So also good news on the Yankees front. Phil Hughes has pitched a couple of games down in the lower leagues, down in AAA and AA. According to reports from Yankee camp, he has two more starts down below, and then we're going to bring him up top. Unless, of course, there's some type of setback, something along those lines, you know. But otherwise, we'll probably see Phil within the next 15 days up for the Yankees. His velocity has been decent. So it's certainly something that bears watching. It would definitely be a shot in the arm to have Hughes back. It would almost be like signing, a free agent. You know what I mean? It's like a freebie. So it would be fantastic to have Hughes back. And the Yankees certainly need him. The Red Sox just lost Clay Buchholz for 15 days. That's definitely going to affect them. Buchholz has been pretty solid for them. He's an innings eater, young guy. But he does have back issues. They've also lost Carl Crawford for another 15 days. So things are going to kind of be interesting for the Red Sox, especially with Crawford, you know, stepping out of the lineup. You know, because their lineup has kind of been clicking now. So now you're taking out, you know, what is, you know, supposed to be a major component out of the lineup. So let's see if that kind of slows the Red Sox roll a little bit. Interesting to see. Right now the Red Sox certainly are looking very good. The power rankings were done by, I believe, USA Today, and according to X number of writers, so on and so forth, they have the Red Sox as number one in the power ratings. The Philadelphia Phillies a close second, and the New York Yankees third. Something interesting, just a little food for thought. You know, you see that the Yankees just aren't playing all that great, but if you look at their numbers, they have the second best record in the American League. They're only behind the Red Sox by a game and a half. So it's, you know, it's kind of like that sleeping giant thing. I mean, God, you think the Yankees are doing so poorly, but they're only a game and a half back, and they have the second best record in the American League. Just imagine if they can pull off a deal or two, what could possibly happen? But in order for the Yankees to go anywhere in the playoffs, they're going to have to pull off a deal or two, and a guy or two is going to have to come back, you know, from the DL successfully in order for that to happen, in order for the Yankees to go far in the playoffs. You know, those things definitely have to happen. Interesting hiring by the Florida Marlins, Jack McKeon, 80 years old. He was kind of born. He was born when Babe Ruth was in his prime. He returned to managing on Monday by accepting the Florida Marlins job. McKeon is the six managerial stint. He's the second oldest manager in baseball history behind Connie Mack, who managed and owned the Philadelphia Athletics when he was 87. According to McKeon, he'll manage until he's 95. He last managed 6 years ago for the Marlins, leading them to the 2003 World Series where they beat the Yankees. You know, so the guy can manage, but, you know, he's up there in age. So, hey, I guess you're never too old. Anyway, that's it for this week. Shout out to all my woodheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, especially my partner, Money Mike. Let's hope we get some more warm weather. Went for my first swim today. Looking forward to many more. That's it for this week, folks. Sayonara.
Thank you, Woody.
Thank you, Lila.
Thank you.
was very enjoyable. I hope you enjoyed it at home. And now we're going to do...
What I got for you first, I got a couple of videos tonight. I got a couple of articles and a couple of videos or recordings that I wanted, audio, that I'm going to play for you. The first one, though, doesn't have anything to do with it really with, well, it kind of does with health, but this is just a three-minute recording by Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. And it's part of his filibuster, but it states, the wealthy keep getting tax breaks while one quarter of all kids need food stamps.
So it is talking about kids' health.
You bet. But it's to
the
point.
Let's listen to this.
And here we go. You can get this on YouTube, by the way, under Bernie Sanders.
Now, also, add insult to injury in terms of this agreement negotiated by the president and the Republicans. While the very wealthiest people in this country became much wealthier and the deficit soared, and under President Bush, the national debt almost doubled, what else happened? Well, the tax rates for the very rich went down. Rich get richer, tax rates go down. This was a result not only of the tax breaks for the rich initiated during the Bush administration, but also, quite frankly, tax policies that took place before President Bush. The result is that from 1992 to 2007, the latest statistics that we have, the effective federal tax rate, what people really pay for the top 400 income earners, was cut almost in half. So these crybabies, these multimillionaires and billionaires, these people who are making out like bandits, they are crying and crying and crying, but their effective tax rates for the top 400 income earners in America was cut almost in half from 1992 to 2007.
And
I think the point
president
that needs to be made is that when is enough enough? And that really is the essence of what we're talking about. When does greed, and greed is in my view, it's like a sickness. It's like an addiction. You know, we know people who are on heroin, they can't stop. They destroy their lives. They need more and more heroin. There are people who can't stop smoking. They have problems with nicotine. They get addicted to cigarettes, cost them their health. People have problems with food. You know, we all have our share of addictions. But I would hope that for these people who are worth hundreds of millions of dollars, they will look around them and say, there is something more important in life than the richest people becoming richer when we have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world. Maybe they will understand that they are Americans, part of a great nation which is in trouble today. Maybe they've got to go back to the Bible or whatever they believe in, and understanding that there is virtue in sharing, in reaching out, that you can't get it all. But I think this is an issue that we have got to stay on and stay on and stay on. This greed, this reckless, uncontrollable greed is almost like a disease, which is hurting this country terribly. How can anybody be proud to say that I'm a multimillionaire and I'm getting a huge tax break and one quarter of the kids in this country is on food stamps? How do you be proud of that? I don't know.
So,
there you go.
That's what we're going to be talking about in a different way, about the greed that's affected our health and our environment.
Yeah. It's terrible.
And our children.
It's absolutely terrible. And hang on 1 second here. I'll get back to this in a second. One other, leading into this, I want to, before, in the next few minutes, I'm going to bring up a video, an audio portion of a speech given by a remarkable lady, an activist, who talks about the absolute unbelievable craziness of our system. Okay. If I can find it. The before I wanted to do that, I did want to mention the Fukushima, because I did mention this on the intro to the Fukushima strontium levels up to 240 times over legal limit near the plant. Uninhabitable land area, now the size of 17 Manhattans.
Representing the first time the substance has been detected at the crippled plant, the Tokyo Electric Power Plant reported on Sunday that seawater and groundwater samples taken near the ravaged Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant facility in Japan have tested positive for radioactive strontium. And according to a recent report in the Japan Times, the levels of strontium detected were up to 240 times over the legal limit, indicating a serious environmental and health threat.
Now that, by the way, is the radiation limits quoted back in May, were 7.5 million times, the legal amount. That was reported back then by the same paper.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's been reduced to 240 times. Now, you can't believe anything they're saying.
I don't believe that it's reduced.
You can't believe anything.
Well, they probably changed the legal limit.
Well, not just that. They probably changed the legal limit.
And that's why it looks like it's gone down, but it really hasn't.
It was actually in May when I reported this last. It was 7.5 million times the legal limit. And in San Francisco, 14,000 times the legal limit.
Yep.
All right.
Now it's
down into the hundreds of it. But the EPA has also changed its radiation limits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, since then, as well as Japan. But now they're talking about 17 Manhattans. I think it's probably worse than that. It's uninhabitable. All right, and they're not reporting this stuff. This is the first report that's been out in probably 2 months, or at least a month and a half.
Well, let's continue with it. Radioactive strontium, which is known to accumulate in bones and eventually lead to diseases like cancer and leukemia, is one of at least three hot particles being continually released by the damaged plant, according to experts. The others include radioactive cesium and plutonium, both of which are implicated in causing birth defects, cancer, and death. We're discovering hot particles everywhere in Japan, even Tokyo, said Arnold Gundersen, a former nuclear industry senior vice president with 39 years of nuclear engineering experience, to Al Jazeera. Scientists are finding these everywhere. Over the last 90 days, these hot particles have continued to fall and are being deposited in high concentration. A lot of people are picking these up in car engine filters. TEPCO has allegedly installed a new water decontamination system that it claims will eventually help filter dangerous radioactive isotopes from polluted water.
And this limit environmental and human exposure to the poisons. But that system has already run into several problems. Its flow rates have been lower than intended. Fukushima has three nuclear reactors exposed and four fuel cores exposed, added Gunderson. You probably have the equivalent of 20 nuclear reactor cores because of the fuel cores, and they are all in desperate need of being cooled, and there is no means to cool them effectively. Al Jazeera also reports that a nuclear waste advisor to the Japanese government recently explained that roughly 966 square kilometers, or 600 square miles around Fukushima, are now uninhabitable due to the unfolding disaster. And this massive dead zone area is the equivalent size of 17 Manhattans placed next to each other.
Well, we could have our own disaster. One of the nuclear plants in this country is in danger of flooding.
That's exactly right. And I don't know if I...
Do you have that article?
I have that. Give me a second, but I wanted to. I don't remember if I posted that. No. Okay. In the time remaining, because this speech is 18 minutes long, I wanted everyone to know this. But let's see if I can get it on here. tonight, I've got an 18-minute speech that I wanted you to hear. Being in the U.S. increases your chances of getting cancer by 400%.
Oh, my God.
Moving to the U.S. will increase your cancer rate by 400%. U.S. is the only nation that allows engineered corn, milk, and soy onto its shelves. A stunning look at the U.S. food market, competitiveness overseas, consumer lack of knowledge, and the health care system are included in this video.
Let's play that.
And we're going to play this right now.
Okay, we're going to start it right now.
It starts with applause.
First of all, before I get started, I want to take the opportunity to thank all of you for being here, because you are a remarkable group of visionaries and leaders, and it is such an honor to spend this time with you today. So thank you for taking the time out of your weekend. As I like to share, I am such an unlikely crusader for cleaning up the food supply. I was born and raised in Houston, Texas, on Twinkies and Po' Boys. I wasn't a foodie. What I was the oldest of four children, and as you often hear about... I want to take the opportunity to thank all of you for being here, because you are a remarkable group of visionaries and leaders, and it is such an honor to spend this time with you today. So thank you for taking the time out of your weekend. As I like to share, I am such an unlikely crusader for cleaning up the food supply. I was born and raised in Houston, Texas, on Twinkies and Po' Boys. I wasn't a foodie. What I was the oldest of four children, and as you often hear about, I inherited absolutely every single one of those type A, overachieving genes you read about in a firstborn child. And thankfully, I channeled that into business school. I received a full scholarship and graduated as the top woman in my class before going on to serve as a food industry analyst. And when the management teams would come through our offices from Whole Foods and Wild Oats, you know, we kind of thought they had a nice marketing niche carved out. You know, it was either Lifestyles or Rich and Famous or some hippie thing. It just wasn't something that we were particularly on board with. And after doing that for a while, I traded the briefcase for a diaper bag. And with that same type A energy, my husband and I had four kids in 5 years. And up until that point, I really had not given a lot of thought about what was in the food supply. I figured if it was on grocery store shelves, it was safe. Don't tell me what to eat, and please do not tell me what to feed my kids. I had four picky eaters, limited time, limited budget, and I didn't want to hear it. And then one morning, over breakfast, life changed. And our youngest child had an allergic reaction. And in all candor that morning, that breakfast was Lego Mayego waffles, tubes of blue yogurt, and scrambled eggs. And as her face started to swell shut, I was so unfamiliar with what a food allergy actually looked like that I turned to my older three and I said, what did you put in her face? And they all gave me those blank little kid stares. And I got so scared. And I raced her to the pediatrician's office, and she says, you know, Robin, she's having this allergic reaction. What'd you feed the kids for breakfast? And I said, Lego Mayego waffles, blue yogurt, and scrambled eggs. And she said, well, those are three of the top eight allergens. And she starts rattling off all this stuff about food allergies, and I'm thinking, you know, like, how can a child be allergic to food? And so as we got the baby calmed down, got everybody back home, I put everyone down for a nap that day, and every single analytical gene in my body went off because I hadn't known anybody that had had a food allergy when I was a kid. And so I wanted to dig into this data. I wanted to understand what was going on. And that morning 5 years ago, I learned that from 1997 until 2002, there had been a doubling of the peanut allergy.
Mm-hmm.
I also learned at that point that 1 out of 17 kids under the age of 3 now has a food allergy. And I then went on to learn from the Centers for Disease Control that there had been a 265% increase in the rate of hospitalizations related to food allergic reactions. That was doctors checking kids into the ER. That wasn't moms. And so I wanted to know, you know, what is a food allergy? Well, a food allergy is when your body sees food proteins as foreign. And so it launches this inflammatory response to drive out that foreign invader. And so it just begs the question, is there something foreign in our food that wasn't there when we were kids? And so the analytical side of me, I turned to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And I learned that, yes, beginning in the 1990s, new proteins were engineered into our food supply. And it was done to maximize profitability for the food industry. And as Sunny touched on, that made perfect sense to me as an analyst. It drove shareholder value, absolutely the fiduciary responsibility of the corporations that were introducing these proteins. But at the time, no human trials were conducted to see if they were safe. And so milk allergy is the most common allergy in the United States, according to the Wall Street Journal and CNN. And so I wanted to know, you know, is there something in the milk that wasn't there when we were kids? And beginning in 1994, in order to drive profitability for the dairy industry, scientists were able to create this new genetically engineered protein and this synthetic growth hormone and inject it into our cows to help them make more milk. The business model makes perfect sense. It's a brilliant one. But at the same time, what happened is that it was making the animals sick. It was causing ovarian cysts. It was causing mastitis. It was causing lameness. It was causing skin disorders. And for that reason, it increased antibiotic use in those animals. And so governments around the world said, we're going to exercise precaution, and we are not going to allow this into our dairy and into our milk supply because it hasn't yet been proven safe. We took a different approach. We said it hasn't been proven dangerous, so we'll allow it. As I learned that, I thought, how many sippy cups have I filled with this milk? And how many bowls of cereal have I poured it on for my husband, not knowing that Canada, the UK, Australia, Japan, New Zealand, and all 27 countries in Europe didn't allow it when it was introduced in the US in 1994. And so I wanted to know, what are the conditions that we're seeing here in the U.S. Because one of the concerns around this new growth hormone, this synthetic protein, was that it also elevated hormone levels that were linked to breast, prostate, and colon cancer. And so I turned to remarkable organizations like Livestrong and the American Cancer Society because I wanted to know what the rates of cancer were in the U.S. versus the rest of the world. The U.S. has the highest rates of cancer of any country on the planet. And according to the American Cancer Society, migration studies show that if you were to move here from somewhere like Japan, your likelihood of developing cancer increases fourfold. 1 out of 2 American men and 1 out of 3 American women are expected to get cancer in their lifetime. I also learned that 1 out of 8 women has breast cancer. But then what I learned is that only 1 in 10 of those breast cancers are genetic, which means 9 out of 10 of them are environmentally triggered. So kind of like, you know, when you're driving down the highway and you see an accident and you just keep looking and you're not really sure why, I wanted to know, you know, are these other allergies that we're seeing have foreign proteins been introduced into our food there too. And shortly after milk was engineered with this new protein, scientists then engineered soy, and soy is also one of the top 8 allergens. And again, to drive profitability for the soy industry, because soy is primarily used to fatten livestock, scientists were able to engineer the soybean so that it could withstand increasing doses of weed killer. And the business model, as an analyst, made perfect sense. You engineer the seed so that you can sell more weed killer. And at the same time, you've engineered something new into that seed so that you can patent it. So now you've got a patent on the seed and you're selling additional weed killer. But once again, governments around the world said, no studies have been done to show if this is safe to feed to the livestock and to feed to our consumers. And so we're going to exercise precaution in order to prevent the onset of any disease that may result. And in 1996, here in the U.S., we took a different approach. As I kept learning more about food allergies, I was hearing concern from parents about a corn allergy. And so I wanted to know, did corn get engineered? And interestingly, in the late 1990s, as concern started to grow about the spraying of insecticide over cornfields, scientists were able to engineer that insecticide into the DNA of a corn seed so that as a corn plant grows, it releases its own insecticide. As a result, corn was then regulated by the EPA as an insecticide.
Oh, my God.
As you can imagine, this was incredibly hard information to learn. We had introduced a term called substantial equivalence. It was a conceptual tool, and it's used by the tobacco industry to facilitate the approval process of something for which no human trials have been conducted. And that was the justification given for why we were introducing these things in the U.S. And as I sat down one night with my husband, I said, I can't unlearn this. And I don't know what people will say if I try to teach them, but I have to try. And so the next morning, I came downstairs, and I sat our 4 kids down, and I said, you know how Mom has learned some pretty tough stuff about what's going on in our food and how it's not in food in other countries, and it's especially not in food fed to kids? I have to try to do something about that. And one of my boys, he looked at me, and he said, Mom, how many people are on your team? And I said, well, it's you 4 and Daddy. And he said, Mom, you need a bigger team. And he was absolutely right. And at that point, I'd had people come up to me saying, your food's Aaron Brockovich. Your food's Aaron Brockovich. You should reach out to Aaron Brockovich. And at that point, I did not want to be food's Aaron Brockovich. And I thought, how in the world could I possibly reach out to her? But then all those type A genes started going off, and I thought, I have to at least try. If I could get through to somebody like Aaron Brockovich, then maybe we could create this change here in the U.S. And so channeling all of that energy, I honestly spent about 2 weeks crafting a 4-sentence email to Aaron Brockovich. And I fired it off. And I don't know if I ever really expected her to reply, but when she did, to have someone like that cheering you on suddenly makes you think that maybe one person can make a difference. So as I began to really dig into this and look at the fact that we were using all of these new ingredients in the U.S. food supply that we weren't using in other countries, I got to admit, it drove me absolutely nuts how expensive organic food was. And so I looked into the business model. And what I learned is that as a national family, sitting down to our national dinner table with our national budget, our taxpayer resources are being used to grow these crops, to subsidize the growth of these crops with all these chemicals. And then over here, the crops that are grown through the organic process, which means without the use of synthetic chemicals, those guys are charged fees to prove that their stuff is grown without it. Then they're charged fees to then label those things as grown without it. And then on top of that, they don't get the insurance and marketing program assistance that these guys over here do. So not only is their cost structure higher over here, but then on top of that, what I learned is that it wasn't just those farmers that it was impacting. The farmers who are fourth and fifth generation farmers who have been feeding our country for generations, because those seeds are patented, they now have a cost structure that's new too, because they have to pay royalty fees, licensing fees, and trait fees to even begin to plant those seeds on their farm. And so when I thought about this, I thought, how are our American corporations exporting their products if these other countries don't allow these ingredients? And that's when I realized and found research that Kraft and Coca-Cola and Walmart, they are doing a remarkable job of responding to consumer demand in other countries. And they have formulated their products differently. So Kraft and Coca-Cola and Walmart, they don't use these ingredients in the products that they distribute in other countries. Now, when I first learned that, at first, it was kind of depressing. But then I thought, we just need to teach each other here. And as I reflected on the fact that we'd introduced these proteins, there had been all of this toxicity concern, I wanted to know, you know, what are we spending on healthcare versus the rest of the world? The U.S. spends more on healthcare than any country on the planet. 16% of our GDP goes towards managing disease. What that means is that a company like Starbucks spends more on healthcare costs than they do on coffee. And as an American, I realized this very easily could be affecting our global competitiveness. Because rather than driving profitability towards our core competencies in the global marketplace, we're managing disease. And I thought, we don't need to wait for regulation. We don't need to wait for legislation. We can begin to exercise precaution in our own families, in our own communities, and in our own corporations so that we can protect the health and well-being of our families and ultimately of our economy. And as I was coming through all of this knowledge and having dismissed all of it, it was pretty paralyzing. But then I realized you can't make the perfect the enemy of the good. And it's really all about progress, not perfection. And while none of us can do everything, all of us can do one thing. And just as you don't potty train a kid overnight, and you don't wean them from a sippy cup overnight, this is a process that it doesn't happen overnight. But that as each and every single one of us does one thing, we have the ability to affect remarkable change. Because each and every single one of you has talents and attributes that you are uniquely good at. And when you leverage that with something that you are passionate about, you can affect remarkable change in the health of your family, in the health of your company, and in the health of our country. And the bottom line is that there is nothing more patriotic that we could be doing. Thank you.
That was very informative, but scary.
Yeah.
Now we have to do something about it.
Well, the first thing to do was to share it with you people and on this program. And the second thing to do is continue to have you share it with people. And this program was Robin, I forget, by God, isn't it? Ted X Austin, okay, is the name of this company or this group. And,
she said, as an
O'Brien,
with something that you're passionate
I'm sorry,
about.
What?
She Robin O'Brien?
Robin, yeah. Ted X Austin, independently organized. Yeah.
You may get a standing ovation every time you.
Because you are life changed.
I would love to see what happens.
It'll come right on now.
It was behind her. Robin something or other. It doesn't really say it, and you know, you have to.
Her.
But where?
Well, it was right at the beginning. You went over.
No, it wasn't. It really wasn't. Robin O'Brien, yeah.
I was right.
R-O-B-Y-N O-apostrophe B-R-I-E-N.
Yeah.
And you can look that up. And also Ted X Austin is the group that put this out.
Yeah.
So I hope you check it out. I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight, and you know, please join us again tomorrow night when we continue our updates here and our information that we try to share with you every week. So, Lila?
Yeah, we never seem to have enough time to share everything. But
there was so much news this week that I wasn't able to, but tomorrow night we'll continue and have some really good stuff for you.
And we want to thank our guests.
Roy Satter
for his book and the great discussion we have. And we want to thank Woody for his talk on sports. And we'll talk to you tomorrow at the same time, 8
so
o'clock.
Good night. Yeah,
good
have
night,
a good
folks,
night.
And have a good night.
Join us right here tomorrow, 8 o'clock.